Welcome to this week's podcast with a K, available on iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo.
Hey there, listener. I'm Christian Corley. He's James McLean. This is the podcast with a K. We are talking Doctor Who this week, as you probably expect. You probably appreciate as well that we don't always talk about Doctor Who, but we're largely talking about Doctor Who this week and related stuff. Last week we did a show last week, James. Do you recall what we talked about last week? Is this a no?
No, I feel I should. Was it something to do with... No.
No, last week's was we talked about a lot of things, but we just kind of focused on whether or not Doctor Who should change its format.
Oh, yeah, that old chestnut. I remember it well.
And we've had a nice email as well, most importantly, which is what we're actually going to talk about. This is a message that came to us from one of our regular listeners and regular commenters on Facebook. It's a gentleman who you may know that we're going to mention his name now, or he may not. This is a gentleman called Colin Grigson, who...
Which, just for, in case he wants to remain anonymous, we should change it to Colin R. Grigson.
Or Golin Grigson.
I did think about that, but I thought that gag had been done a few many times, so I thought maybe if we just added initial, that would sort of subvert that gag a little by its simplicity.
Okay, I see what you said there. Yeah. Incidentally, did you see Upstart Crow?
No, I didn't.
Mm. Good choice. Anyway, so... Colin suggested. Now we suggested loads of different ways in which Doctor Who could be reformatted, and we were kind of you were kind of advocating a kind of a sort of a serialized format, weren't you?
Yeah, if we do a this week on last week's podcast or whatever we used to do, I can't remember, but it was the idea was a suggestion that in a year's season, so as we have at the moment, say 12 to 13 episodes. It would be interesting if it was broken down into sort of say four sets of three or three sets of four, and each of those batches would have its own sort of self-contained storyline. That doesn't mean they have to be set in exactly the same place. It could be done like your Utopia arc, but it would have a self-contained worlds which you could sort of invest in and then could be returned to sort of broaden out the sort of amount of characters within the Doctor universe which have their own place and space in time, and just sort of jiggle things around a bit. That was the idea.
Yeah. And I think what we're looking for really is interesting new ways of doing Doctor Who.
Yes, that was the point of it, yeah.
Yeah, and Colin's suggestion is really good as well. He says, my pitch for it would be a cross between The Prisoner and Red Dwarf. I'm thinking maybe Gus from Mummy on the Orient Express somehow manages to trap the Doctor on a giant space station and takes his TARDIS, straps a vortex manipulator to his arm, which only Gus can control, and makes him travel through time and space to solve mysteries. Which is a nice kind of... that then grounds the Doctor in a particular place and then has him running around doing jobs for someone, which isn't too different to the UNIT era, is it?
Well, funnily enough, I mean, a lot of these ideas share a certain amount with that very popular story, Keys of Marinus, which has a sort of similar sort of idea, self-contained world where he doesn't use the TARDIS, he's moving from adventure to adventure using, a simplistic time device. And I always thought that was quite, while it perhaps wasn't brilliantly executed, it felt quite innovative and never done really since. I mean, I suppose Key to Time in some ways was a little bit the same, but that self-containment, I think, is what is unusual in science fiction in general, isn't it? You know, you go to a planet is no more than a town, isn't it, really, essentially. Skyro is only really that Dalek city and the bits outside where fowls like to lurk, like
in forests, hanging around the forest at night time.
Parks, yeah.
Maybe that's... walking their dogs, I don't know.
Exactly. So that's what they were doing. They were walking their dogs. And there's that sort of localization of stories, which in science fiction should expand outwards, and invariably, because stories have to be small and to some degrees contract. But so ideas where you can sort of create a bigger world on a small stage, I guess, are kind of interesting. And that's sort of what this idea is as well, is, you know, you're trapping, which isn't one singular place, but a load of interconnected places just to create a realization, isn't it? To create a place, create an aesthetic of a world. And I think we do lose that in Doctor Who, and maybe it's time to try that.
I'm a little bit conscious that we may have just invented Thal dogging.
Thal dogging, well, it is an interesting connotation, especially, you know, them watching, looking through Dalek grills. Dalek's parked out.
Dalek grills, he's a Dalek survival expert, isn't he?
Yes, Dalek grills, yeah, Dalek are grills, just to keep him alive.
Okay, I had an email from Michael Herbert, who I know is a listener. Hello, Michael. And
I'd hope he was.
No, I know he is. He has been up until last week anyway.
Okay.
I'm sure he will be this week. He's the chap who runs the .2 course at the college in Greater Manchester. And there will be a full link in the show notes because I've forgotten which college it is at the moment. And he sent me a link to a blog post he's written where he's transcribed an article from The Guardian in December 1973. With Kit Pedler and Jerry Davis. Now, I thought this was particularly interesting. They're talking about Mutant 59, the Plastic Eater, which I've mentioned on the podcast previously, which is a novel that was released in 1973. It's a disaster novel. It's not a million miles from Doomwatch. And it's an interesting interview because you get more of a feel for Kit Pedler and Jerry Davis than... as I was saying to James before the podcast, the Bristol boys, Bob Baker and Dave Martin, you kind of know quite a bit about them because they wrote a lot of Doctor Who and they wrote a lot of different Doctor Who, whereas Pedler and Davis did mostly Cyberman stuff. And they are slightly enigmatic as well, you know, with Pedler being a genuine scientist. And then, you know, they went off to do Doomwatch and never came back to Doctor Who. So it's an interesting article. There's a few nice quotes from them, but the bit I really like is this bit at the beginning of the article from The Guardian. "London is melting," screams the blurb on the back cover of the American edition of an uncomfortable bit of predict fiction, which will hit the station bookstalls here this week. The French titled it La Mort du Plastique, which is spoken slowly in a gravelly voice, has a nice doom-laden aura. In Britain, we'll just be reading Mutant 59, The Plastic Eater. And I've been reading it for a while. Unfortunately, I did punctuate it with... I'm up to the third volume now of Michael Palin's diaries. But I will be returning to Mutant 59 once I've got to the end of Palin's last so far released diary. And it has got a nice... The opening is, although set in a more commercey industrial world... is very reminiscent of a Fleming Bond novel. So it's certainly a good start. Where it's going to go from there, whether it's going to be pulpy or whether it's actually going to be more like something like Doomwatch or their Cybermen, I don't know. Was there anything in the interview you're interested in, or are you just happy for me to share that interesting
tip? I was quite interested in the predict fiction.
Mm.
I thought that was an interesting classification. So, I mean, that, I assume, refers to fiction which is sort of predictive to future catastrophes. But I've never heard of that as a generic term before. So it's obviously one that didn't stick.
Yes.
It's always interesting when you get these sort of generic terms and you think, why don't they stick? And there's some people say that, you know, for generic terms to stick, they've got to be sort of taken up by more than one industry. So it's not just enough that the critics use it, that the audiences have to use it as well. Or if industry uses it, it's got to be something that the critics will embrace. There's got to be something which establishes it. And this feels like something which has just got lost. I've never heard of that term before.
There's possibly an argument that they or the publishers didn't want to be described as science fiction because the science fiction thing wasn't really a good label, was it?
No, that's it. And so you've got this whole thing of changing cultural tastes and that shifts and affects how we label stuff.
Yeah, I mean, this book is very much in the thriller area rather than the science fiction area. I mean, it's a science fiction concept with basically it's rogue plastic. It's plastic that mutates and breaks and isn't as long lasting as it's supposed to be. So clearly a science fiction concept, but not a science fiction book. It does feel more like a 1960s thriller.
But I mean, the other nice thing about the article is its temporal location, isn't it? That it's not. It's obviously it can't be, but it's not retrospective now. This is a 1973 article, so you get that feeling of a moment in time which is relevant to Kit Pedler and Joe Davis, especially with Doomwatch and the like, having passed really their Doctor Who era. But so I always kind of like that thing with these sort of articles.
So there's a link to that in the show notes. So take a look at that if you're interested. It's certainly worth a read. Oh, do you know, I was just nodding off the other night and I was thinking to myself, my God, poor John Barrowman, he must be out of work. I've not heard from him in literally weeks.
Mm.
And then he pops up.
Actually, I think last week he had a picture of him and Billy Piper that was doing the rounds, just to keep everyone remembering that he exists.
Was it really?
Yeah, there was a team-up picture of the two of them.
Was he singing? Was there any singing?
No, I think they were sort of doing a selfie pose.
Thank the Lord for small mercies. Then.
And, just to remind everyone that John Barrowman is still there. He's very skilled at that.
Indeed. Now, what I'm going to do, I'm going to press a button on my computer and the listener's going to hear this. I'm not sure if you are.
Probably be bad at war, though, wouldn't it? Because you wouldn't want everyone to know you're there at war. You'd probably be a very bad soldier. He's a terrible sniper.
I'm sure he'd love the uniform, though. Could Captain Jack be about to appear in Doctor Who? This is what he posted to Facebook. So, yeah, he's back in Cardiff next week or the week after, and he's not telling us why. There's two bets. One is that he's going to be in class, and the other one is that he's going to be in the Christmas Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
So we already know that Pearl Mackie's busy at the moment until June in The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime at the Gielgud Theatre. And they're filming the Doctor Who Christmas special shortly, so the Doctor needs someone to talk to. Could it be Captain Jack? What do you think?
My gut was sort of thinking more class myself.
Right.
That maybe it was a sort of a back end of class that was being filmed. I mean, I don't know when are they actually, have they actually started doing filming for the Christmas one?
Well, they should be doing it soon, yeah. If you haven't already started, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting point. I mean, I suppose you could argue that would perhaps be more likely. I don't know. I mean,
Do you want to see him or not?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been quite fond of Captain Jack, even though he occasionally does sort of slip into sort of superhero mode. Certainly in Miracle Day, he just sort of looked really out of place in that storyline, appearing and disappearing akin to Batman.
Everyone looked out of place in Miracle Day.
Yeah, that's true. But I'd like to see him come back. I mean, there's an interesting thing. I was talking to one of our colleagues about fan perceptions of John Barrowman, of Jack, and how a lot of people still seem to think of him as a Stephen Moffat character, because obviously he debuted in The Empty Child.
Yeah.
And because I was sort of suggesting that there does seem to be, and I could be doing him a great disservice, but I've always felt that Stephen Moffat's always been preferable to using his own material rather than using others, except when it comes to classic material, which I think every fan sees as their purview that they can use or is theirs anyway. There's a sort of feeling that classicdom belongs to everyone. But I always got the impression that Captain Jack was definitively a Davis concept.
Yeah, I think he's a Davis concept. I obviously introduced in a Moffat script, but yeah, he was absolutely. I'm pretty sure it was outlined by Davis. Yeah.
I mean, otherwise, Torchwood would probably have to say at the bottom in the same way they'd have to, you know, with the Cybermen, you know, that these were created by someone who doesn't run Torchwood. So yeah, I've no doubt that he is considered a Davis character in the same way that River Song appeared in a Davis era, but was very clearly a Stephen Moffat character and has been used constantly ever since. So I always got the impression that Jack never appeared because there was no feeling of
ownership.
Ownership. There's no sort of parochial feeling that this was his character. And I don't mean that in a dismissive way either. I mean, when it's not your character and it's the people who created the character are still alive, so it's different to say Terry Nation's estate,
mm-hmm.
you may feel a certain lack of engagement in taking someone else's character on and playing around with them a bit.
Well, how many times has another writer written for River Song?
Well,
zero on TV.
Well, yeah, I'm not quite sure how many times in Big Finish now. She seems to be popping up a fair few times.
Yeah, she does, yeah. But yeah, zero times on TV. And how many times has another writer written for Captain Jack? A handful of times, but it's in Torchwood.
Yeah.
Not in Doctor Who.
So I think, you know, with these new, the current strain of Doctor Who ownership writers, so I'm talking about people who own characters within Doctor Who, it has set very much within their grounds. Which obviously, if Captain Jack's coming back, is going to change, since Moffat's involved in both those and Davis isn't.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think there has been a lot of resistance from Moffat's era to actually engage with the Davis era. We talked about this years ago when this was happening. I thought that was a shame, and maybe it was to do with Moffat wanting to a clean new slate like the old Doctor Who writers did and enjoy that feeling of doing, you know, a brave new world and not having to, you know, have to be part of that last world. I mean, you got that very clearly, say, between Troughton and Pertwee, for instance.
Okay, so what about there is an elephant in the room? John Frobisher.
Right. Where's the elephant here?
John Frobisher is the character played by Peter Capaldi in Children of Earth.
Oh, right, him, yes.
Permanent Secretary to the Home Office, who was later appointed, I quote from Wikia, informal ambassador to the 456, and his job became increasingly difficult when everyone around him began to shirk any responsibility for the disaster that was unfolding.
Well, he's not really, because he's never been... I mean, there's been a vague reference, hasn't there, to... No, there's not.
No. Well, no, what I'm saying is, Captain Jack, meeting the 12th Doctor, he's going to see the face of John Frobisher.
Oh, I see. I see. Yes, I see. You Doctor Who fans think ahead of the game. I haven't got there yet.
You haven't got that far yet.
No. Well, I mean, he might just...
Will they go for that drama? Will they forget it ever happened?
I think unfortunately they will go for it. And maybe they're damned if they do, damned if they don't. Because if they don't, people will say, well, surely that's unrealistic.
They've got to, haven't they? Because of what happened last season. With the call back to Fighter Pompeii.
I mean, there's just so many in reference lines and so many jokey lines and so many what people would call meta lines, meta referencing, that, you know, the audience aware comments that are aimed at the audience more than they are at the characters, that you're there sort of saying, hey, we're aware that the audience know that this character is played by the same actor, so perhaps we need to reference it. And as I agree with you, because they've already done that meta referencing last series, they're going to have, or series before that, they might want to have to bring it up again. I don't know. It just feels a bit claustrophobic, doesn't it? I've always liked the idea because, I mean, you take the X-Files, which we obviously have a few times this year. You know, Chris Carter has always reused a lot of his actors several times within each series and then in between other series he does. I always kind of like the idea that, I mean, there are certain mental states where people are unable to recognize faces. I always kind of like the idea that maybe that happens on a more normal level, that we meet people who look like other people all the time, but for some reason we don't just quite see it. But if you're outside of our universe looking in, you would see multiple versions of the same person. It's just in the same way, you know, that everyone knows purple, but does everyone see the same purple? And that sort of kind of feeling is a sort of in-world way of justifying multiple characters that no one recognises is identical. I don't know. I know it doesn't work. It doesn't work properly. But I suppose what I'm trying to say is if you're all part of the same system of science, then you can't see outside that system of science. You can't actually define whether that system of science is accurate when you're part of the equation. You know, an equation can't equate itself, is what I'm saying.
Okay. Has that ever happened to you? Have you ever sort of like seen someone who you thought was someone else?
Yeah, well, no, I mean, my ex-girlfriend always said in the town that we lived in that there was another girl that people said looked exactly like her who would wander around, and she had that several times, as if there was a doppelganger of her in the same.
Right. Funnily enough, there's a guy who lots of people think is me, and he's an even bigger arsehole. He lived, at least, I don't know if he still does, he did at one point, he lived in Redcar, and he had glasses. Now, I don't wear glasses out, because mine are just for reading, but they were those ones that go brown in sunlight, that type of thing. I always think they look a bit sinister. You know the one of the henchmen in For Your Eyes Only with the octagonal rimmed glasses?
Yeah.
Always reminds me of that. Anyway, but what I was going to say is it happened to me. I went to Sheffield when my best mate was at university. I went down to Sheffield to stay with him for a few days and do going to pubs and that sort of thing as a student, because I was still at college rather than at university. And I went to college for a bit longer than most people. And I got off at Meadowhall by mistake. So I'd never been to Sheffield before. And there was a Meadowhall interchange and a Sheffield interchange. And I got off at Meadowhall interchange by mistake because I was asleep. And I woke up, saw the word interchange and got off. And so I wandered around Meadowhall and Meadowhall interchange for about 4 hours waiting for my mate to turn up. There was a guy who looked almost exactly like him there. Which now, unfortunately, there was no... I realised in time that it wasn't him. But it's a very strange situation to be going somewhere to meet someone and bump into someone who looked exactly like him.
No, I think, yeah. I think, obviously we have these little moments in real life, and obviously in television fiction, sometimes we have stories which are, you know, Michael Knight and... I suppose his was Justified with his doppelganger, but you always get the story, don't you, where there's someone who looks exactly like them, and if they just wear a moustache or a hat, they can be... But I mean, I always think of it like take He-Man, where you have a show where the archetype designs for each character template is multi-used, so you get people who look very similar to each other.
Yeah.
With just different hair colours or different tans and everything.
Or a moustache.
Or a moustache, yeah, absolutely. So maybe their universes, that is as it is, and no one notices the difference. Like I say, they just don't see it, and maybe that is what these sort of universes are like. Obviously, Doctor Who isn't like that totally. But I still like to think it is, because, I mean, Mr. Bronson has appeared, Michael Sheard has appeared so many times in Doctor Who. I like to think that while we can see it, the characters can't, in the same way that characters in He-Man don't see the similarities.
Yeah.
So that's how I like to try and justify it in my own little head.
And you called me a Doctor Who fan.
I this isn't just about Doctor Who. This is predominantly an issue I've had with so many shows, predominantly He-Man and She-Ra.
You've been watching a lot of those lately?
I haven't, no, but they always remain close to my heart.
Okay. How's more of a Ulysses, man?
I have that as well. Very good, if sort of slightly downbeat show. But I'm almost finished the Clone Wars, incidentally.
Oh, have you?
Okay. Yeah. Very, very sad, some of that.
Okay. Don't share. Now, it's interesting that we were... a couple of things. First of all, if you say purview again, I'm going to go on Malcolm Tucker on you.
Okay.
And secondly, we were talking about meta and in-jokes and references and things, and this brings us squarely to my review of the Fourth Doctor issue 2 from Titan.
How professional. Absolutely. Carry on.
Yes. Now, you can read my full review on the DoctorWhoCompanion.com. Which you probably know is a kind of it's basically the old Cast Erebus team doing their own thing, with occasional input from me on a technical and occasional article.
It's basically like K9 and Company, but done right.
Yeah, that makes me the Doctor.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, actually, it sort of more makes you John Nathan Turner.
No, it makes me the Doctor.
Well, I'm sorry, I think you're more of a John Nathan Turner myself.
I don't have any of those types of shirts. Albeit. So basically, yes, this is issue 2. We mentioned issue 1, or I mentioned issue 1 a few weeks ago, when that came out. And this is a continuation. It's by Gordon Rennie. It's a great strip. It's squarely in the Gothic Hinchcliffe era. It's the Fourth Doctor and Sarah. More or less authentic, apart from two things. The Doctor calls Sarah Jane far too often. You go back and watch the Fourth Doctor, he very rarely says Sarah Jane.
Mm.
He usually calls her Sarah, or to someone else calls her Miss Smith, or gives her the full name Sarah Jane Smith when he's introducing her. And there's the in-jokes. There's about half a dozen now that I found of clever little nods that are very amusing and very cleverly introduced. But when you find them, suddenly you're not in the world. You're thinking, oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
And the fiction's broken. It's like breaking the fourth wall. And I'm so irritated by it. It really must stop, because this is a good tale.
Well, I think it is actually breaking the fourth wall. I mean, okay, you're not directly breaking it, but you are essentially breaking it.
Mm.
You're making audiences you're reminding audiences this is a television show or an audio play. So, yeah.
So, and it's the problem with this is that I think with something like Doctor Who, it must be really hard to avoid the temptation to do this. Although then again, having reminded myself today that I have written a Doctor Who comic strip that did reasonably well and raised a lot of money for charity that I don't like to talk about, there is a meta reference, there is a reference to you, a pop culture reference. It isn't that difficult to avoid doing it, because I'm pretty sure we didn't do it at all, apart from a single reference to the Time War in the third part. Well,
there's a difference between intercontinuity referencing and in jokes.
That's where I was going. So I think it is possible to avoid it. And I think the problem is that it's with Doctor Who. I think Doctor Who is probably particularly guilty of it because of its big history, but it is something that tends to permeate everything, not just genre stuff. Now it just seems to just permeate every fictional type and genre and universe at the moment.
Well, I think there's sort of two kinds. I think there is a kind which is done for comedy, which is recognizing the sort of fallibility of the drama, and there's a type that is done for justification, which is another sort of fallibility, where you're sort of looking at like for instance, where Rose, it's a quite legitimate one, this, where Rose says to the Doctor, why do you sound like you come from the north?
Mm.
You're sort of, you know, that's a, it is a bit of comedy still, but it's not done for comedy. It's really done to sort of, for a sort of a slight justification of the fallibility of the fact that an alien sounds like they come from Manchester.
Yeah.
And I think in both cases, and they're both very similar, they both are about the vulnerability of fiction. And I think that is when they get dangerous, is when you do it too much. And we said this the other week with the recent Companion premiere with the Dalek, that the amount of attacks on the Daleks did exactly what Douglas Adams' script editing of Destiny of the Daleks did.
Yeah.
And you sort of get to the point where you're making in jokes to acknowledge the vulnerability in your script, that people might be thinking, why can't these Daleks get upstairs? Why aren't people noticing that these have got sink plungers on the end? You know, and it becomes a point where it does become deconstructive. And as you say, as soon as you do that, the drama gets deconstructed. So, yeah, I think you're totally right. You've got to be very careful when you put them in. And there is a tendency, I think, in fiction, because fiction is so aware that we are deconstructive as audiences, that they've got to keep acknowledging the vulnerabilities. I think it's a mixture of that and the continuities. I think we've said this before, that you sometimes reference continuity to try and get audiences to feel that this is a universe. You know, when the Doctor says, I've been to Rome before, I might have burnt it down, or something like that, you're trying to say, hey, you remember that old black and white story that's got nothing of style to do with this one, or aesthetic? They're linked. Maybe if they say that they're linked, you'll be able to believe that they're linked, because you want to believe it. So I suppose that sort of in-joke exists as well. But again, that's all about vulnerability of fiction, isn't it? Acknowledging that there's too much distance for people to be able to make that connection, and trying to connect them with a joke. It's a fascinating topic, really.
Well, it also, without saying too much about Doctor Who Companion, without saying too much about Doctor Who, the fourth Doctor issue two, it is a very good story. It's got a good villain, Miss Havisham style, shrouded villainous, with a hand of stone, and there's plenty of jeopardy and threat for Sarah and the Doctor. So, despite my misgivings, I would seriously recommend you take a look at it.
Do you think being comics, do you think comics need to be more aware, or do you think they naturally are places where you have to be aware because they are so divorced from? Because they have a really weird divorce nature from reality, in the sense that while they've got, while an audio play, you have to vision, or sorry, like, or with a book, you don't have audio or vision, you just have your imagination. But in a comic book, you have someone else's imagination that may create a tension with your own conception. So you've got that sort of fight. So I wonder whether comic books, to some degree, have an issue there, and so I wonder whether in jokes are better for comic books because it's sort of,
I don't know if that's the thing.
Medium, or does it make it worse?
I think maybe part of this is that sort of, I know Doctor Who magazine kind of have got better in the last 3 or 4 years with their strip, but it's at a general level since 2005, Doctor Who comic strips have not been very good. IDW strips were amalgams of okay stories and quite bad artwork at times. And Titan had an opportunity to improve that, and they did improve on that, but they kept one of these particular elements, which is all the meta references, ramped up to 11 through through the 11th Doctor and 12th Doctor and back with the 10th Doctor. And I took it as an opportunity for them to get it right. And I think with this fourth Doctor series, they have got it more right than they have with some other ones. But there's, unfortunately, it does seem that there's still work to do. Do you know what this does, though?
What's that?
This brings us nicely back to the question I asked you at the beginning of the show about Upstart Crow. Because I did watch Upstart Crow, and I'm still quite frustrated by Upstart Crow. And if you don't know, listener, this is a new sitcom by Ben Elton. Only Ben Elton, though. There's no Richard Curtis to be seen nor heard. In kind of the vein of Blackadder, because it's set in Elizabethan times, it's about William Shakespeare with David Mitchell. Hello, I'm David Mitchell. That David Mitchell, not the other one. As Shakespeare. And it has a good setup. And it has some good casting. And there's some good jokes in there. But it has three very annoying failings. Failing number one, Shakespeare's daughter is more or less from 2015, 2016. She's a contemporary daughter. There's no time travel involved. It's supposed to be funny. Failing number two, Mark Heap is playing Stephen Fry as Lord Melchett. And failing number three, if you can imagine such a thing, Spencer Jones is playing Ricky Gervais. As the famed actor Kemp. So it's a frustrating combination of what we've just been talking about in comic form brought into the sitcom world, and I'm very annoyed by it because it should be far better than it is. I just had to get it off my chest.
That's all right. I can totally understand. I've not seen it, so I'm a little divorced of comment.
No, that's fine. I mean, if our listener wants to check it out, by all means do so. Or if you've seen it and you have some thoughts on it, do share your thoughts with us. We're going to be going soon, but there is one thing that we wanted to talk about, which is the Eighth Doctor.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's had a lot of adventures, hasn't he?
I've only seen two.
He's had two on telly, and then he's had a load in book form and in comic form. And in audio form, and I think there's probably a case to say that he is the Doctor with the longest lifespan, in terms of adventures anyway, maybe not actual physical living for however many years.
It's interesting to see how he competes Christmas. With the Seventh. Him and the Seventh must have a good fight going.
I think Eighth probably edges it, but just for the amount of time that he had like 9 years, didn't he? Whereas the Seventh only had
seven,
yeah. Between episodes, or between Doctor Who being on air. So yeah, so we I found this interesting thing on Facebook that someone had shared. I'm just going to bring that link up now. Basically, it's a timeline for the Eighth Doctor. And I think it's interesting because it shows, if anything, a vast number of different styles to the same character of the Doctor, which is something we don't get on television. So we've got Doctor Who the movie, then from BBC Books, The Eight Doctors through Vampire Science. No mention of The Dying Day, so I'm not sure whether that would come, which is a Virgin book. Then Short Trips and Short Stories where he's alone. Then Vampire Science through to The Gallifrey Chronicles, still with BBC Books. And then we go into The Big Finish World. And there actually isn't any mention of the comic strips in this, which would obviously need to be dealt with as well, really. But, I mean, it's a vast collection. There's the Mary Shelley trilogy. There's everything with Charlie Pollard. Everything with Lucy Miller. Then there's The Dark Eyes and Doom Coalition. The Time War starting. The Diary of River Song. Then everything in Titan Comics, at least, but nothing in DWM or IDW. And then To the Night of the Doctor. It seems to be more or less accurate. But it's just looking at it on paper and or on the screen and seeing it in any form of order just shows what a vast and interesting tapestry the Eighth Doctor is.
So, I mean, they've not really spoken about the conflicts between the BBC Books and Big Finish there. I know they've tried to slot them in between, haven't they?
Mm.
Which I know has been sort of suggested as they can be done before. It's quite interesting. It's I must admit, I've only read listened to a few of the sort of more relevant Big Finish ones, yeah, of the Eighth. I've listened to I've watched the two, obviously, and I did sort of go through a period of going through the BBC Books, sort of the Ancestor Cell, Godfather, Grandfather Paradox, Father Time, that sort of era. I found was really interesting
Really good.
I really enjoyed that. He's a funny Doctor, Paul McGann's, given that until Big Finish, there was only 90 minutes to establish him. And the rest, he was probably the only Doctor that was more established through writership, through authorship, than it was through personality, through portrayal. Mm. And then obviously, when he gets to Big Finish, he gets to re-own it and define it. And to be honest, I think what was interesting was it wasn't that different to what he did in the movie. I thought that was kind of cool. I mean, obviously goes through darker moments, but essentially the personality, his portrayal, remains the same. Where if you take, say, Peter Davison's portrayal of the Doctor in Big Finish compared to the television show, I'd say they're quite different.
It's something I've noticed about McGann recently over the last few years, is that, and this is absolutely no criticism of Paul McGann, because, you know, I'm a Doctor Who fan. I've been following Paul McGann for years. I'm a massive With Nell and I fan, so I know what a good actor he is. But he does tend on TV to be cast in quite boring roles.
Mm-hmm.
I've been watching Luther recently, and he's the first series. I don't know if he lasts beyond the first series. He plays a guy called Mark North, and he's a very dull character.
Mm.
And Paul McGann's a far better actor than that. I mean, he goes, you know, he covers every pretty much emotion and performance type going in his Doctor Who debut. And the same could be said with Nell and I. And then he does tend to get these very sort of dull roles on TV, and it baffles me, really.
Yeah. I mean, I think his Doctor would have been very interesting if he'd sort of had the sort of Tennant-like, I know people call it the emo arc, which I know I've said before, I think is quite insulting.
That's something like Roxy Music.
To understand emo rather than Eno, yeah.
Oh, sorry.
I can understand. Well, I don't understand that, you know, obviously, as I say, what they gave the Tenth Doctor was something which was very dark and upsetting for any humanist, as the Doctor's meant to be. But I think McGann would have done that very well, because I think you're right. I think there's a danger between being someone who has a sort of very natural, sensitive emotion and being given roles which are essentially ineffectual.
Yeah.
I think there is a difference between the two, and unfortunately he'll end up ineffectual when the roles he does very well are ones which are sort of quite sensitive and genuine sort of personalities. And I think maybe that's what the Doctor role was giving him, and he has sort of had a chance to play out a bit in the audios, because you do get that feeling. Mm. There's a sort of very heartfelt sort of personality to the Doctor through his character, more so than any of them.
I think so, yeah.
I can't think of any of them which don't feel quite, maybe Eccleston's to some degree. But I would say that McGann's is the most genuine character out of all of them. And I don't mean that in a rude way. The eccentricity is massively played down. And you feel that the character cares about stuff. His most human version, isn't he? Which I suppose fits in with the movie. But there we go.
Yeah. Indeed. That's a nice way to end the podcast with a K. We'll be back next time. Goodbye.